Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Nina.
How are you? We have another podcast to do.
I know, podcast number 8. Visions of Freedom.
Right, let me just say something about the title, which is Visions of Freedom is the title of our podcast because you and I are plotting to create a new issue of the quarterly wrap-up for Solari, and that is going to be bearing a title of Visions of Freedom. There will be a lot of goodies in it, talking about freedom and independence and personal freedom and national freedom and sovereignty and many other issues. And we thought that we might start the whole thing by talking about movies that you and I like for various reasons, to talk about what I call the dash to freedom means to various people or nations in movies. How about that?
I think that's great. You got me to watch my favorite freedom movie all over again, and I liked it even better. I don't even know how many times I've seen it, but I liked it best of all this time.
What is your favorite freedom movie? Tell me.
Oh, I'm not going to do that one first. Remember, I'm going to do another one first.
Okay, do your first movie, and then we'll do what we usually do. You have your 2 or 3 favorite ones, then I have a favorite 2 and 3 ones, and then we're going to see what we're going to recommend. So what is your first one?
So my first is The Passion of Christ, Mel Gibson's movie on Christ, which was so incredibly controversial. And I chose it because I really believe that one of the greatest powers, you know, always when you talk about tyranny versus freedom, that's where the freedom fighters going to get their power. And I think the greatest power on the planet for me, which can, you know, kind of lead this effort, is the Christ, what one of my friends calls the Christ energy. You know, if you read the Declaration of Independence and the different documents that created the United States, they talk about our freedom coming to us by divine authority, which is certainly what I believe is true. And the Christ story has incredible and very powerful lessons. And of course, Gibson did it in a very, very powerful way. But I wanted to go through some of the lessons that you see in this movie that really get to the heart of the issue of tyranny versus freedom. Mm-hmm. One is that ultimately freedom is a spiritual concern. And if you are going to fight for freedom, first and foremost, you have to do it spiritually. There's a great scene by the Jesus Christ movie made by the Italian director. I think you would remember his name. It's the one where Jacqueline Bisset is plays Mary. And
There is one. Well, that actually, in the interest of kind of housekeeping, let me identify the film that you are talking about, because the problem is that there is a lot of movies entitled The Passion of the Christ.
Right. Right.
This is the one that is directed by Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson doesn't appear in it. The figure of Christ is actually played by an actor called Jim Caviezel. And I'm saying that just because there has been many, many television and feature films about The Passion of Christ. And it's the specific one that you're talking about, which is actually very important for the history of cinema, but I can talk about it at the end. So I'm
switching into the Italian for a second. There's this wonderful scene where they're at the wedding where Jesus is turns water into wine at Mary's request. And the apostles are all mad at Jesus because he's drinking wine and having a lot of fun. And they keep bugging him and saying, come on, we've got to go organize against the Romans. And he basically says to him, you guys just don't get it. And what he's describing is, this is a spiritual battle. This is not political. So you see in The Passion that first and foremost, this is political. The second thing you see is it's financial, because what gets Jesus in trouble is he throws the money changers out of the temple. You know, and so the central bankers have been with us through a long time, and they've hidden behind, you know, they always hide behind the sacred institution. I used to always say the reason that the most beautiful church in New Orleans is by the water is that's where the pirates hide their money. Anyway, so but you have to understand that Jesus messed with the central bankers of his time, and that was the problem. And so, but the third thing is, and this is a critical issue of today that has to be dealt with, when Pontius Pilate knows it's really bad politics to kill Jesus, and he doesn't want to, his wife warns him, you know, don't do this. This is really going to, you know, I mean, think about the legacy you have now if you're Pontius Pilate. So Pilate tries to get out of it by inviting the crowd, giving the crowd the opportunity to let one guy off the hook. And he offers, how do you pronounce it? Barabbas versus Jesus. And the crowd, of course, lets the criminal off the hook. And so Jesus gets crucified. And so, you know, the Romans, the central bankers are very clever because they get the Romans to, you know, to do the dirty work, but then the crowd buys into it. And of course, we see this tactic all the time, compromising freedom. We're watching it right now in the United States because there's a big effort on to, you know, sort of engineer a civil war, and you get the people to do the dirty work for you. You know, you get the crowd to support what's against their own freedom. Anyway, so it's got a lot of great messages about freedom, and including how brutal the fight for freedom is. Anyway, so I would say that is a story, and I think Gibson did a marvelous job. Of course, very controversial. So I'll turn it to you for the history of movie making.
Well, all I wanted to say is that at the time, there were two things. Well, first of all, it was directed by an actor and not by a so-called professional director. So there were always, you know, people who were opposing him saying, well, you know, he's not going to do a very good job because he's really not a very experienced director. He's more of a film star. Little did they knew. The other one was that everybody was saying, well, this is a great religious theme, but this is the type of movie that is going to do well around Easter time for certain audiences, but it's not a really major blockbuster. And he proved them wrong on both counts, because the film was not only very, very good, but also it was extremely successful as a box office, made him a major kind of mover and shaker in Hollywood, thanks to the success of this film.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that film was kind of very kind of important in the industry as an outlier, as a movie that was not supposed to make that much money, but it did, which spoke to a lot of things, to the fact that he was tapping into the power of all the people of faith, but also, as you say, maybe to the theme that was dear to a lot of people, regardless of Hollywood. In other words, people who normally would not go and see a Hollywood film, they went and saw this movie. But because this is the film that, or the story, you know, we all know the book, so to speak. So the book has been filmed a few times before. So from the point of view of film industry, it's not easy to make a movie on a very well-known material and still be successful, just because there are many versions of the same story that have been filmed, and he managed to overcome all of this. So from the point of view of the film, you know, film history, if you like, this is also a fascinating example of, you know, sometimes you're going to have an outlier and something that is going to succeed despite all the predictions. I also wanted to speak to something that just triggered my memory when you were saying about the fact that the biggest power in the fight for freedom, if you like, is the power of people's minds, or the power of ideas that overcomes everything else. Because in the list of movies that we are going to do for the Visions of Freedom, we have placed a film called The Battle of Algiers, which is kind of an old 1966 film, which is a black and white directed by Gillo Pontecorvo, who is an Italian kind of drama director. And he talks about the uprising in 1950 of Algiers against the French colonialism. And I have read somewhere that even fairly recently, in 2000s, Pentagon has been using this film as an instruction film to show,
really?
Yes, to show to people that you may, doesn't matter how much of the military or tactical advantage you have over the enemy, if you cannot win the people's minds, so to speak, hearts and minds, as they were saying, I think they were using it during the Iraq War or something, then you're going to always lose, because that's what this Battle of Algiers is showing. The guerrilla fighters, the Algerians who are the guerrilla fighters, have basically nothing other than bare hands and their determination to get rid of the colonial power, whereas the French state obviously is the French state and has everything and still loses. So this is a perfect example of when the time for an idea has come, nothing can stop that idea, which is my bad misquoting of a kind of well-known quotation. But the battle of idea, in a battle of ideas, the ideas will always win eventually against the material.
Right.
But that's just an aside. I think it's time for me to introduce the first piece of cinematic adventure that talks about freedom. And for me, strangely enough, is a TV series called Turn, Washington Spies, which deals with the American Revolution. And from the point of view of someone who may not be very, very well versed in the American Revolution, and I'm thinking about the non-American audiences of this show, this is actually fascinating, because a lot of American audience would be quite familiar from school with the history of a group of spirit-minded citizens who started supporting the American Revolution by civilians who started to work as spies on the side of the revolutionary fighters. But this is not something that is extremely well known outside maybe people living in the United States and being familiar with the history of their own country. Just to say what the show is about, the show is about, it's based on a book by Alexander Rose, and it talks about the historical fact of exactly that there was a group of civilian in 1776 who have been recruited by Benjamin Talmadge to work on the side of the revolutionaries as kind of the first ever military spies. And they invented things like, the coded message by a woman hanging her petticoat on the washing line as a sign that, the coast is clear, or by using invisible ink and dead letter box, and all these inventions of the spycraft that they were literally making it up as they went along. And all of this is actually historically true. So this is a fascinating story. What I loved about this show also was this very kind of realistic production design of the world in 1700s America, where, everything is, it's a pre-technological world. Communication is just between people talking to each other. There are wooden carts with horses. There are farm fields. The world kind of is moving much more slowly. you feel like you have actually gone back in time and entered that world. And then you obviously are amazed at looking at this handful of people. You know, this is Benjamin Talmadge and several of his friends in New York who are trusting each other because they are childhood friends. And they try to gather intelligence about the movement of the British troops and American loyalists by literally going to taverns and listening to what people are saying. So it's kind of low level technology, if you like, or lack of it. And at the same time, this handful of people is able to aid the victory of the American Revolution. So you see how very few people who are just basically dedicated, decent people who are farmers, you know, they are not intellectuals, they are not soldiers, they're just ordinary people who can affect change because what they see around them tells them that it's time for them to help out, time to take some action into their hands. For me, it's just a fascinating story to watch.
So one of the things I've read several times, is that the British said that they lost the Revolutionary War because Washington and the Americans put together an outstanding intelligence operation.
Well, that is exactly what is being shown there, that they were able to right. root out Major Andre, and who is this biggest traitor, who is the symbol of being a traitor in American Revolution. Benedict Arnold, right.
Benedict
so
Arnold.
They kind of out them by
right.
literally talking to various people and realizing, you know, what is really going on and then intercepting some letters. You know, I'm sure that the numerous historians of that period of American history are very well versed and much better than you and I can explain that. But the show does touch upon it. And what is fascinating is just this is basically a group of ordinary citizens, of people who don't have any training because these spy networks or spies as a profession doesn't exist. They are just making their own as they go. They are inventing the spy craft, if you like. And that is fascinating that,
right.
you know, so few people can do so much. And now you top that, right?
Well, it's funny because I've never watched it, and I've always wondered if I would like it or not. But I'm definitely thinking of picking it up. I think I saw one show, and but I'm assuming we can stream it, right?
Yes, it was originally, I think, an ABC television show, which now is somewhere probably streaming. On one of the streaming
right.
services. And I kind of stumbled upon it at some point when I was writing something for Solari. But as I say, it is almost bigger fun for someone who is not very well versed in American history, meaning a non-American. Because if you live in Europe or Asia or Latin America, you're not maybe that well versed because you're not taught about these personages at school. But I think it's fun for everybody. It's just I'm saying that it's fascinating to discover that aspect of something that we kind of know from the point of view, you know, Washington crossing Delaware, a very lofty perspective. This is a different perspective, which is why I like that.
So it was interesting to me because I grew up in a world where intelligence was everything and fantastic efforts were made to access, you know, superior intelligence. You know, on Wall Street, the guy who's got 2% information wins against the guy who's got 1% information. So anything that gives you an intelligence edge is invaluable. And so great effort is made into getting and being a superior on the intelligence front. And then after I got booted out of the establishment, I walked into a world where people were oblivious and saw no need to make any kind of effort or expend any kind of resources on getting intelligence. And I was stunned. I thought, wow, what a way to live. But I, you know, it certainly left me with the belief that good intelligence was essential. If you were going to be free, you had to have a good map.
Exactly. And I think that's
Right.
what that show is exactly talking about, you know, that in order for them to succeed against the overwhelming British and loyalist armies, they need to have an edge, and that edge is created by an idea of, oh, okay, we need to have very good spies, and we don't want them to be caught, which is where the invisible ink and, you know, coded messages come in, rather than, you know.
One of my favorite ideas I've ever heard for real solutions was Bill Binney, who used to be the senior technical guy at the NSA, said we ought to change the curriculum in all the schools so the kids from the youngest age on up are learning how to make their own encryption systems. And he said, you know, if every community has hundreds of homegrown encryption systems, it'll drive them crazy. They'll never be able to deal with it.
Well, that's probably
I
in
thought that was
the
great.
realm of utopia, but something that people who lived in or were raised in the free world would probably not be aware at all, but people who were raised, let's say, behind the Iron Curtain would know that if you
Right.
were a kid, well, I would say about 4 years old, by age of four, you would know that whatever it's being said at home is never ever repeated at school, because
Right.
you can get your parents into trouble. So even a 4-year-old, by, you know, by the time you went to school at 6 or 7, you knew it by heart. But even a 4-year-old knew whatever is being said at the kitchen table does not get repeated outside home, because that leads to mommy and daddy being arrested. So, you
Right.
know, there are parts of the world where very early on children would have learned that, just because this is the world they were living in. What's your next movie?
Okay. My next movie is one of my favorite movies. I can't tell you how many times I've watched this movie because I'll start a movie and it's dreadful and I'll think, you know, I'm just going to do something I've already seen. And this one is just an automatic great movie at the end of the day. So usually when you talk about freedom, we think about political freedom, but there's also freedom at the workplace.
Never heard of it,
And
but
that's one
maybe it
is
exists.
But that's what Unstoppable is. Unstoppable is a Denzel Washington movie. Denzel Washington cannot make a movie that I don't enjoy
True.
or love.
True.
Right. Yeah. I just think Denzel Washington is basically the cat's meow of actors. I just think he's
Yeah, he
fantastic.
can't go
And
wrong.
you can't go wrong with Denzel Washington. And then it's Chris Pines. And Denzel Washington, Chris Pines are train engineers. Now, the other thing is, I love trains. I've always loved trains. Not only that, they're based in Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up. And it's the story of two train engineers who are on a line when a freight train gets loose and starts speeding down the track without an engineer in a way which is exceptionally dangerous and can kill. You know, once it gets into urban areas, it can kill thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, because it's carrying, you know, it's carrying some environmentally toxic loads. Anyway, so the corporate bureaucracy, I don't want to give away the whole plot, but the corporate bureaucracy tries to micromanage the situation. And finally, you know, you've got this corporate hierarchy of people who are, you know, they're better at playing golf and doing financial engineering than running a railroad. And so Chris Pines and Denzel Washington decide to take the situation in their own hands and just go fix it. And so the corporate guys threaten to fire them and they tell the corporate guys to go jump in a lake and they go fix it. It has a very happy ending. You know, I hate to give it away, but I love happy endings anyway. But it's really a perfect example of, you know, the great American who, you know, really cares about doing the right thing, really cares about community, really cares about other people, and is experienced and knows what they're doing. You know, getting together and just making things work vis-a-vis the, you know, the Wall Street bankers who are running companies into the ground. It's kind of the Wall Street versus the man on the street in the venue of of a train crisis in the middle of Pennsylvania. Anyway, but Tony Scott filmed it, who is my all-time favorite director. And so it's Tony Scott and Denzel Washington and Chris Pine, and it's an action movie. It's full of action and full of suspense and beautifully filmed. But it's really about freedom because Denzel Washington and Chris Pine just decide, we're free people and you're not going to stop us from doing the right thing by our fellow man just because, you're our employer. And as we know, a lot of the very tyrannical things going on in the world right now are being, that employers are ordered to enforce them and to, sort of inflict them on people. And I think one of the things that's going to have to happen is we're going to have to see, the revolution is going to be a whole lot of people saying, we're not working for companies that require us to do inhuman things.
Well,
So bye.
sorry, from your mouth to God's ears, I have a much more pessimistic outlook at, because what I think what's happening at companies, because there's less and less workplaces because of various reasons, there's basically less jobs on the planet. And I think the employers have more and more power and the employees have less and less power. That's my take on it.
Right.
But maybe this is why this movie may resonate very well with a lot of viewers saying, well, this is how it should be. I think what Denzel and Chris Pine's characters have as an advantage is that they are the people with the know-how, which the corporate
Right.
guys do not, and the train is going. So they are the only people who can actually save the situation. And I think that kind of
Right.
employees are still having a lot of power. The problem is that as more and more the companies are based on technology for various reasons, then the power is moving from people that maybe have some generally humanistic training of managing people and thinking of the good of the people are going to be less and less in power, and more the people who just basically are looking at the technological aspect. And that is
Right.
never good for humanity, I would say, because the
Well, the other thing is, when I saw this, one of the reasons I started my own company, when I left the administration, is when you're in an environment, and you saw this increasingly in the United States, you had way too many people focused on CYA as opposed to, get the job done. And at some point, if you're going to make things work, if you're going to be productive, you've got to get things done. You've got to do the right thing. And you got to stop worrying about CYA and start worrying about getting the job done. So, it's that tension that you see in Unstoppable between the guy who's trying to do CYA and make sure that, his insurance company is happy, or his lobbyist is happy, or the board is happy, as opposed to, getting a hold of the situation, doing the right thing, stopping the wrong thing from happening, and taking care of your responsibility.
Well, I agree with you. And one of the things that I always admired about America for a very long time was that this was the only land I knew that there was a meritocracy, meaning that it didn't matter, how good was your English or where you came from or whatever your background or social class was. If you knew how to do the job, then you were the right person for the job. Whereas in a lot of places of the world, this is not how it worked. Oh, it doesn't work even now. But I think it is even changing here slightly, and that is filling me with
Yep,
certain dreads.
absolutely.
But that's a different conversation than talking about the wonderful movie called Unstoppable that we are recommending. And let's talk about another one.
Here's the thing. I just want to say, give one other plug for Unstoppable. When it's finished, you feel free.
Ha.
You're like, I'm a free human being. I can do this. It leaves you with that just great feeling of what it feels like to be free.
Well, it's also,
It's a great feeling.
yeah, and it's the mark of good movies. The good movies are the ones that you should be coming out of the theater smiling, unless it's a very depressing drama, but you should be smiling.
Well, you come out smiling on the Passion of Christ because remember the resurrection. I mean, the Easter is one of my favorite times of the year. So, Christmas and Easter, because, you know, we have the victory. There you go. So yeah, I like feel good movies. Okay, Nina, you're next.
Okay, well, that is another television show. I somehow seem to be drawn to them today. And I just want to talk about it because whenever we talk about, you know, fighting for freedom or independence, one of the most obvious ones is obviously the national independence or the right to self-determination as a nation. And in Europe, which is the continent that I'm most familiar with, a country that has a long history of that is Scotland. Well, a country, a nation, let's say, which, as we know, is the land that has been fighting for the independence from mainly England for centuries. And there is a show that is using a time travel device, but not in a very much in your face way, in order to move the characters into the 18th century Scotland. Just to do a very basic description of the show, it is a story of a nurse who has survived the Second World War as a wartime nurse. It's 1945. She, by accident, steps through the kind of like little Stonehenge stones into 200 years back into the 1700s, mid-1700s in Scotland, which is the time of Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Scottish fights against the English, which culminate with the Battle of Culloden, which basically wiped out the Scottish independence in 1745. The show is based on a series of fantastic books by Diana Gabaldon that cover a period of approximately 20, 30 years in history of Scotland and America of the time. And the show is still ongoing. I think it's in this fourth season. And the books are going to take the protagonists all the way through the American Revolutions and take place in America in later editions. So there's a lot to watch about the fight for independence in two different continents. But going back to the very beginning of it, this is talking about the Scottish independence fights of the Bonnie Prince Charlie period. And for me, it is like with the Washington Spies, even though there is this kind of fantasy element of the time travel, it is at the end of the day a very detailed and fascinating kind of historical panorama of the time of, you know, of 18th century, that it's almost as if you were able to step together with the characters, to step back 200 years and kind of look at the daily life in 18th century Scotland. For me, this is fascinating. And again, this is a kind of step-by-step panorama of what it meant to be a freedom fighter. All the Scots want to do is to have their peace in their Scottish Highlands and farm and live in peace. But England obviously would like to have the entire island under the British crown or English crown rather than only half of it. So there is a conflict on, you know, one piece of land called, you know, the island, and two different nations that are kind of trying to duke it out. I find it fascinating, and I like the books a little bit more than the show because the books are full of extremely well-researched historical details and descriptions that the show is less able to kind of provide. But it is a very good introduction to Scottish history that I knew very little about before I read those books, and now I seem to know quite a lot, and I'm very grateful for it.
You're right. The historical detail is fascinating. I love how she has to explain away her health knowledge and sort of adapt her nursing to, that time period. She's always on, or for a long time at the beginning, she's on pins and needles trying to kind of explain how she knows what she knows. It's kind of interesting, the transition.
And also, by contrast, you see how much the medical knowledge has advanced in 200 years. The world in which she lands is basically a few herbs and a prayer, and that's all that can be done to cure any illness or, prevent pregnancy or stave off infection or cure cancer or anything. All you have, you don't even have surgical instruments because they are only starting to be introduced and they are very crude and primitive. And then obviously you move to 100 years later, or in her case to 1945 and then to 1960s, where there are antibiotics. So the penicillin is the game
So you see,
changer.
that's all the pr that's all the price of Da Vinci not having a good publisher. The moral of the story is we need good publishers.
Correct.
Okay, so you're ready for me to go?
Absolutely.
So still in Scotland, my all-time favorite freedom movie is Braveheart. Again, Mel Gibson, this time in the starring role. And Mel Gibson plays one of the great heroes, one of the great freedom fighters of all time that I know of, is William Wallace, who literally turned around the, basically helped organize Scotland, including the aristocrats. And then when Robert the Bruce became king, really helped build the groundswell to throw the brutes out. And it's quite a story. But Gibson manages to just do a really inspiring role. He starts off as a guy who very well educated, but just wants to be a farmer and be left alone. He's not looking to fight. He's not an angry guy. And one thing leads to another. And of course, tyranny always interrupts your fun. And in the story, I don't want to give away the plot, but of course the bad guys do something that really upset everybody. And the next thing you know, the Gibson character, William Wallace, is off, starting and leading the revolution. And one of the things that comes out is the importance of leadership, but also the importance of what I would call the mandate of heaven. The mandate of heaven, you probably know more about it than I do, is the Chinese concept that the leader really must earn the approval and the support of, the divine authority. And it's I would say it's something, it's in the field. You've got there is a field, there is a consciousness, and you've got to earn that. There has to be a covenant, and you have to earn it. And Wallace does a series of things which makes it clear that leadership and building that covenant is more important than life itself, because he ultimately sacrifices his life to kind of bring the team together. And the brutality of the way the British kill him is what ultimately gathers the clans to defeat the British. And it's interesting because in the story, some of the people behind the British king know it's really, it's back to the Pontius Pilate thing. They know it's bad karma to do this.
Well, it
And of
is.
course they do the killing, and of course in the end the field wins. The killing doesn't work because the resurrection in the field occurs.
Well, I think, all powers that be know that creating martyrs is always a two-edged sword, meaning you get rid of somebody that is inconvenient, who is ever going to get rid of me of that meddlesome priest kind of thing. But at the same time, creating martyrs is exactly what the authorities do not want. And that's why ever, all the time in the history of various countries and wars, the authorities would try not to create martyrs because they always know that creating a martyr is one of the most dangerous things in combating any kind of revolution, right?
So my number one favorite movie, back to the Scott brothers of old time, is Gladiator. And one of my favorite scenes that the Slayer Report subscribers have heard many times is in the slave quarters when they're having lunch and the fellow gladiators are afraid that they, that the Romans are going to poison Russell Crowe. So they insist on tasting his meal before he eats it. And it turns out there's no poison. And so one gladiator turns to me and says, "You have a great name. Before they can kill you, they have to kill your name."
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, right. The power of myth, which martyrdom creates myths, of course, is sometimes stronger than anything else. This is exactly turning back to what we were talking about, that the ideas can be sometimes stronger than warfare. And also, I see that you're choosing, with Mel Gibson and Denzel Washington, you're choosing the guys that are really, really nice. I mean, not only as characters in movies, but they're actually nice people in real private life, I can
really
tell you that.
Well, you would know that. You know all these guys. I don't know any of them.
Yes, I do know them all. And Mel Gibson in real life is extremely nice person,
Really?
Very nice guy. Just a decent, nice person. And so is Denzel, actually. So,
I've never watched a movie by Mel Gibson or Denzel Washington that the worst thing they've ever done is something I really enjoyed, and most of them are just fantastic. So
I can tell you, Brad, that this is extremely rare for a film star to actually be nice in real life because it's very difficult to achieve. But it probably crosses on screen, where they are in real life.
Uh-huh.
So I want to kind of finish my list with something that is a huge kind of blockbuster size film that talks about, I'm not saying anything new here, but probably a lot of people would agree with me that the Second World War is probably one of the last times in kind of history that the people who are fighting in it could probably say that they were fighting for the good cause. All the wars afterwards mm-hmm. were a little bit dirty or extremely dirty. And maybe you couldn't feel that good about, fighting, but the Second World War was one of those last times that enormous amount of people, for example, in Europe, were just basically trying to defend their lives, their homes, their families, their cities and their countries. From an invasion of a foreign power, and the lines were very cut and dry and black and white. I can't think of wars afterwards that would be that cut and dry. So the movie that I want to talk about is directed by someone who is much more well known as a director of either huge comic book fantasy films or very complicated Bond movie style movies, and that is Christopher Nolan, who's just had a new movie out, and I will be actually writing about it. Christopher Nolan's latest movie is called Tenet, and it has just come out. My next Food for the Soul is actually going to be about this film. But the movie that I want to talk about here is called Dunkirk, which I think you like as well.
It was movie of the year it came out.
Exactly.
On the Slayer Report.
Exactly. Yeah. And
because you got me to watch it.
And because I wrote about it. But I love this movie for two reasons. One is because from the film craft standpoint, it is an amazing feat of presenting a wartime event in a novel way, which is not easy. Christopher Nolan is very well known for being fascinated with time, with reversal of time, with parallel times, with time from the point of view of let's say quantum physics, not only with time as a timeline. But obviously, he's talking about a very well-known, a very well-documented historical event where he would have, hundreds of historians watching every second of what he's putting on screen because this is, the history of the Second World War. So he cannot take liberties with that too much. But what he's doing is that he's showing us three different plot lines, if you like. And one of them is the action of what is happening on the Dunkirk beach when Britain is trying to extract close to 400,000 soldiers who are stuck on the French-Belgian coast in May of 1914. The action at Dunkirk started on May 26, 1940. And that action takes place on that beach for a week. The second plot line is what is happening on the water once the soldiers have been picked up by the boats and they are being strafed by Luftwaffe planes, German planes, while they're on water. And that plot line takes one day. And then there is an aerial fight on Spitfire against Messerschmitt in the air. And that action takes 1 hour. So it's 1 week, 1 day, and 1 hour. Those three plot lines and three kind of groups of heroes, if you like, or characters, are what is the backbone of this of the narration in this film. And it takes someone like Christopher Nolan to show all these things at the same time, three different timelines running to tell the story, which is also told from the point of view of all the soldiers that are participating in the action. There are no grandstand pieces of, generals talking in, in a war room and deciding things. It's all you're on that beach, you're in that ship being drowned, or you're in that plane being shot at. It is an amazing storytelling, and it's obviously talking about one of the most incredible moments in war history because what has happened is that there were, hundreds of thousands of soldiers that are stuck on a tiny beach. Looks like there is no hope for them, and then they get saved at the last minute by a huge mobilization, not only of the army but also of the private boats, because there were, I don't know, 150 small vessels, private little pleasure boats, yachts, fishing boats that went from England across the channel to help, get the soldiers off the beach into the main ships to transport them back to England. The historical moment is obviously extremely moving and emotional, but also the way he tells the story is fascinating. I love that movie. What did you think of this film?
So you really feel the friction of war. I agree with you. You're really there. You feel it. You feel what it's like. And the other thing I would say is it's the cinematography is I thought was breathtaking. It was really beautifully done. So I loved it. Now, I assumed you picked it because between Washington Spies, Braveheart, and Outlander, we were making the Brits look pretty bad.
Which
And Dunkirk makes them look pretty good.
well, because in reality, it depends at the moment of in history. What you and I are trying to look at is a kind of illustrations of the same theme that sometimes people have to make a stand and fight for their, physical freedom or mental freedom or some kind of independence just because they have no place to run, which is, literally illustrated in Dunkirk, where these people were just stuck, at the edge of water, and either they would perish or they would somehow be saved or they would fight back. There was no other option for them. Sometimes it's because you fight for the ideas that are bigger than the reality around, which is what you're referring to in the Passion of the Christ. But or you have this the metaphoric, of course, or the fictional story of Unstoppable, where you're talking about the people who are just saying, well, in order to save other people, all I have to do is defy the authorities and try to stop the bloody train, which, you know, it could be a real train or it could be a metaphor for whatever is happening with, I don't know, corruption or some kind of malfeasance that is maybe not physical. That's what we're exploring in those movies, is the ways that the artists are trying to talk about the fact that sometimes people will fight like cornered rats for whatever they perceive is being taken away from them, no matter what is their personal cost. And sometimes the good guys are the Brits, and sometimes the bad guys are the Brits in the movies that we have chosen. I don't think it's personal, so to speak. I mean, personally, I like all the British people.
I was just being funny. I'll never forget when I was an associate at Dillon Reed. Every year, if you became a vice president, you would get a case of Aubryon wine.
Oh, nice.
Because, you know, the Dillons own the Aubryon vineyards. And you've never met a more obedient group than the Dillon Reed Associates. They had not a revolutionary bone in their body. They were just trying to please the partners every way they could. But the year I became a vice president, they tried to renege on the cases of Aubryon. Mm-hmm. And there was a revolt. And what the partners discovered was that the tradition of getting that case was something that had kept the associates, you know, working 3 days straight with no sleep. The idea that they would make a vice president and get that case of wine. So to take it away was to take away the magic in the field of being an officer at Dillon Reed. And that was not to be tolerated. And you've never seen a more ferocious group of people than that group of, you know, sort of one day vice presidents who wanted their case of Aubryon wine. Of course, the value of it was going up tremendously, which is part of the you know, that was a major bonus, although, you know, obviously you were going to drink it. You weren't going to bank it anyway, but, you know, it's that it comes back to that covenant, whatever that invisible, mysterious thing is. You know, when the hearts of men share a common vision of, you know, of living free. It's a beautiful thing. And all these different movies really sort of capture the magic and the beauty of that. I was just thinking, one of my favorite words is one I learned from Carolyn Casey. It's called chitino. It's Brazilian. Mm-hmm. It means the magic that comes in dangerous times. And all of these movies have that, the magic that comes in dangerous times.
Oh, how beautifully said. I think this is a perfect way to finish our podcast, because I cannot top that kind of beautiful statement. I'm just going to say, you know, my usual joke that, you know, we have now again managed to waste a perfectly good hour of our listeners' time, but maybe not totally wasted, because maybe we have given some listeners ideas as to what they could watch next if they want to be inspired.
Well, I'm going to watch Washington Spies. You've got me going. You already got me to watch Dunkirk, so that's done. But I'm going to watch Washington Spies. That's next.
And I'm going to watch Unstoppable. See, we already have made recommendations
for each
other. You've
never seen Unstoppable?
You know, I have seen it, but a long time ago. And I think this is a movie worth rewatching. I just haven't seen it in a long time. So the last recommendation I can make is that we are working on this Visions of Freedom subscriber issue soon that will develop all the ideas that we just have had here. And there will be a list of films that we highly recommend. So
yes.
This is something to look forward to if you're a subscriber. And otherwise, we're going to have other podcasts. Thank you.
Nina, thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening, okay?
You too. Thank you very much, Catherine. Bye.
Thank you.